Digital maps hold the power to help bring context to complex environmental and humanitarian issues and move the needle forward on some of our more pressing challenges. The Global Fishing Watch manages collaborations with 11 institutions to use big data and machine learning to answer critical questions about marine biology, economics, and policy. We're talking about global fishing patterns, monitoring environmental resources, and how fishing in the world's ocean is changing. Hello, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. For this next hour, we're going to be learning digital maps. We're probably not going to be learning all about them, but from the ground to the cloud, new solutions for environmental stewardship. Joining me to shed light on this incredibly complex and exciting collaborations engaged in finding and executing the solution is David Kruidsma, who's the Director of Research at Global Fishing Watch, which is a big job. David, it's great to have you here. And I really am excited about this. I'm obsessed with the oceans. I watch every special that ever comes on TV. So this space that you're working in is pretty, to me, evolutionary and revolutionary. So let's do it. If you don't mind, I'd like to set the stage for why we wanted to do a show on the work of Global Fishing Watch and why it matters to us in the first place. According to the World Wildlife Fund and many other credible organizations like Seafood Watch, approximately 3 billion people in the world rely on both wild-caught and farmed seafood as their primary source of protein. For many Americans, it's simply another choice on the menu item. But for those billions of people, it's how they live and survive. So do you agree with that bold assessment? I mean, in America, we don't get it that without seafood, lots of people wouldn't have any protein.
Yeah, I think that's right. And first of all, thank you again for having me on. It is, especially in developing countries, you imagine along the world's coastlines, people rely on the ocean to eat, and it's a significant portion, which it's the primary protein source for, I think it's like a billion people on the planet is from the oceans. And so it's a critical way to sustain humanity.
But seriously, when I Googled it this morning and looked it up, and it said that there are really 3 billion people that rely on it for their primary source. And think about that. The high concentrations of people on the coasts all over the world, and that's how they eat and live. I mean, just even in Mexico and around the Sea of Cortez, like probably 100% of the people that live there, fish is what they eat. It's, you know, they're not eating a lot of...
Yeah, and I think... It's absolutely the case, and the exact number is a little tricky of how many people rely on it because it's because people rely on a mix of proteins, but it's a significant portion of people in the world.
It's a big number
that really need food from the oceans.
So before we get into the, I call it the macro and the micro. The macro, I want to know about Global Fishing Watch, its mission, its vision, and why the work you're doing is much needed, perhaps now more than ever before. I find myself saying that a lot lately, but it's the truth. Things are not getting better on the global scene in many cases that are as it relates to health of the ocean. So talk about the mission and vision of the organization that you have a major part of impacting.
So Global Fishing Watch was started... I want to say in 2014 was when it really started. And it was first a project of two nonprofits and Google. So it was started as people from a nonprofit called Sky Truth, which is a nonprofit focused on creating transparency by using satellite imageries to do environmental monitoring. And then Oceana, one of the world's largest marine conservation nonprofits. And then Google, who has a lot of, you know, their for good arm was interested in how they could use their new big data techniques to improve monitoring the ocean. And they came together and decided that each of those three organizations had something to contribute to make this project Global Fishing Watch. And the whole idea of it is, conceptually, it's the idea that we don't really know what's happening on the ocean. Is there a way to make the activity of fishing boats more transparent? The key technology it relies on or has relied on so far is that large vessels large vessel, ocean-going vessels are required to carry transponders that broadcast their location so that other boats nearby can see where they are. You can think about this as, you know, you want to, when you're on the water, you want to know if there's a tanker, you know, 10 miles away so you can make sure you don't run into it. So it's collision avoidance, and it's mandated on very large boats. There's about 300,000 to 400,000 of these vessels in the world that are large enough to have these transponders. Regulation varies by country, but it's, you know, in the U.S., it's boats over 65 feet. Globally, it's at least about 100 feet is the size. So these are big boats. And of those 300,000 and some boats, maybe about 60,000 to 70,000 are fishing vessels. And the idea is these boats are broadcasting their position every few seconds as they move on the ocean. And those positions can be picked up by satellites flying overhead. Now, that's not, they're not designed to track boats that way, but you can do it that way. So imagine they have a GPS on board. It picks up their location. They send their location over radio. And then we pick up that message from satellite. And what we've done is we've purchased a database of all of these position messages of boats. And this is a very big database. Now we're getting 50 million messages per day. And you can imagine if you plot that, you get the movements of a few hundred thousand boats and how they move on the water and where they go and what they do. And what we are doing is doing some machine learning algorithms, which basically means you look at how the boat moves and decide what kind of boat it is. And we use that to identify the fishing boats. And then we do another one which says, based on how they move, do we think they're fishing or do we think they're just transiting or going to port or doing something else? And so in that way, we're able to identify all of the world's fishing activity by these large vessels. And so the first time ever, you can put that on a map and see where fishing is happening across the globe.
So this is to David Kruidsma, the human being, not the researcher. It's like, at some level, does that just blow your mind? Like 50 million messages a day, signal a day. I mean, in the aggregate, that just is kind of mind-blowing. So that you're watching that. Like, I can't even get my head around
it. Oh, it's super cool. I mean, it's super cool. I mean, there's this, like, I can give you my spiel about why to work on environmental data. There's three reasons to work on environmental data. The first is that it's really cool and interesting. You know, you can make maps. Maps are really fun, and all environmental data is spatial, and you can plot on a map and look at it, and it's just cool to look at this global map of fishing effort. You see all these little features you never noticed before, and it's just like beautiful, and it just comes out of this huge amount of data. So it's really, really cool and fun. The second reason is that it's really socially important, right? So you have this fun element of it, like, wow, I'm working on this really cool, interesting data set, and it's so fun to look at, which is, you know, one reason. Like, but then the second element is, wow, this actually really matters. As you said, there's like, you know, maybe a billion people who really rely on the food coming from from the oceans, and we need to really understand how we're using it. It matters a lot to society what we say from these data. And then the third reason is that, well, this is not really a reason, is that there is a lot of opportunity in it. Like, no one's really doing this work in a sense, the scales we should be. And you can think of that, it's kind of because there's not a lot of money in it, because it's for social good. You know, if I were trying to do something to make better algorithms for creating ads for you to click on the internet, it would be really hard because lots of people are working on that. But there's not a lot of people doing this. And so it's really, every time we do something, it's like we've made a big discovery and we've pushed it ahead. So we're doing something that's really fascinating, really exciting, has very extremely socially relevant, and we're able to make discoveries. So it's really, it's really, really, really exciting.
It's really exciting. And, you know, we kind of like just breeze past it, that it is so important. But think about what I do. I'm an environmental educator, so of course I think it's important. But other than, it's really, really important when you talk about how many people it feeds and what happens if there's dead zones and what happens if entire species are overfished. That's the Gina Murphy darling, Mrs. Green reasons. Why is it important to you? Why do you get so excited about it that we identify through this data? What's the point?
Well, I think, you know, there's the big picture and there's the small, there's the kind of personal. So the big, you know, the personal is that there are people that, as you said, that are there each day are going to fish. And that's their livelihood or it's what feeds their family. And so it really matters quite a lot. There's also people who are, there's also lots of bad things that happen in the fishing industry. There's lots of forced labor that's still occurring. It's absolutely horrendous. And I just hear some stories of it. You want to be able to stop it and you want to make things more transparent. So there's a lot of individual stories that really kind of grab at you for why you want to improve the fishing industry. Then there's the big picture, which is kind of just that I also find very compelling and engaging, which is kind of this big question of how do we use the world's ocean? How do we use this global resource? And as I said, there's this very humanitarian drive for this, but then there's also this very kind of almost intellectual question of what is the right way for humanity to use this shared common resource? You know, think about the high seas, which are owned by no one and owned by everyone. What's the right way to divide up that resource fairly? It's a really hard intellectual question as much as it is a humanitarian. And so I think it's something that I find that is just both fascinating and important.
It's fascinating, but there, like you talk about the environmental impact, that those concerns are huge. And we are a global economy. We are one planet, but a lot of people don't think about it that way. I'm sure you find that. It's like, well, here's the American, the parts of the Atlantic Ocean, here's parts of the Pacific Ocean, and going down maybe into the Gulf of Mexico. But there's really not this sense, or is there, of a global connection, because I'm on the board for an intercultural organization in Mexico and Arizona called SEDO. And our area of focus is the Sea of Cortez. And, you know, yes, we want to save the vaquita, but what we're really doing is working with villages and fishermen, because it's so easy to sit where I sit and say, oh, you know, they shouldn't do that. They shouldn't, they're overfishing that area. And then that's supper. Like, that's supper for the family. So it is complex, and there are lots of social issues related to it. Right. And being on the SEDO board has helped educate me about the complexity of it. And good, I call it data. Some people call it data, but I call it data. Maybe that's because I'm from the East Coast. But it really helps to inform our decisions as an organization. But we want it. Are there organizations globally other than obvious ones like Oceana and, you know, Seafood Watch and everybody at the Monterey Bay and all of those people? Who's wanting what you're finding out?
Governments. I think the thing that has really struck me about working in this space is how little good data there is actually in fisheries. Is that there's so much just trying to, you know, before our global database of fishing effort, like you look at maps of where people thought fishing was happening in the high seas, and they're wrong because they were based on kind of incomplete information. And it's always amazing to me what is not known about the high seas, especially, which is the area more than 200 nautical miles from shore. So the area is far away from shore is just always been out of sight, you know, over the horizon and not really tracked. And just to start have concrete data about what's happening there feels very, it's just a big step forward. I don't think people realize that. It's kind of like before, imagine what the world was like before we had Google Maps, you know, it's like you paper maps, but it's like, it was hard to even get maps of things sometimes, you know, you had to order or something and it feels like maybe where the oceans is always a little behind. And so we're starting to get that, you know, we're starting to get better tracking of what's happening offshore.
I heard a presentation at Bioneers in October by the woman who runs Google Earth. And you talk about thousands of people in an auditorium and people didn't even exhale. They couldn't believe what she was saying. We were like on the edge of our seats for what they are doing and how they are able to help people because they are Google Earth. And I came home and I told my husband, you're right, honey. They know everything about us. It's like Google Earth is watching, so don't worry about putting your social security number on your driver's license. Google Earth, they've got you ready. I mean, it's really scary.
I
don't know about that either, but I'm prone to hyperbole. But when you talk about the oceans, and I said to you a little bit before we got on air, I am obsessed with watching things about the ocean, and it is still the deep blue sea. It is the darkness. It is, we don't know a thumbnail about what's going on in the oceans, if you ask me. It's just new discoveries every day. And how will this technology help? Like, how deep can you go? And what is it finding out that's surprising the global fishing community?
Well, there's been a lot of things, I think, that have been surprising. I can go over a whole series of papers that we've kind of helped help publish. So in the last 2 years, we've had about 15 research papers that have been produced from our research partners.
And people should look at your website to find out, because there's a lot of really good things to find out there and easy to navigate. And it's globalfishingwatch.org, which will be on, you know, the show page when we put it up. But so just give me a couple of examples of what you've learned. What were surprises for you, David?
Well, you know, we published a paper in Science last year, and I think one of the most surprising things about it was looking at the looking at fishing effort over the course of the year and seeing that it didn't change with the seasons, but it changed a lot with like holidays and weekends. So it was really interesting to see that what really mattered to when people fish wasn't like it was summer or winter. It was like, is it Tuesday? Because I'm taking Friday and Saturday off. And then the biggest drops, well, China mandates they have a moratorium in their summer months. You're not allowed to fish then. And that's the biggest signal in all our data, is that this restriction on fishing in China. And then this, after that, the two biggest drops in the data are, one, Christmas, and two, the Chinese New Year.
Those
are the two times of fishing. Yeah, exactly. So there's this whole idea that, like, you know, yeah, it's really good for a fish when people go on vacation. So a good fishing policies mandate more national holidays, then you'll save more fish.
That's really hysterical. I mean, it seriously is. I can't wait to tell my brother the fisherman. I'm sure I can stump him on that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's you know. Excuse me. That one isn't as important in terms of saying conservation, but it is like is one of the things that's just like really interesting you get out of the data. Then there's other more important things, such as they analyzed activity of fishing on the high seas and found that it was not profitable. Because what you can actually do is you can look at the movements of each boat and say how much are they, what's the cost of operating this vessel. And then you can estimate more or less what's caught in that part of the ocean and come up with an estimate of like how profitable is this fishery. And we can do that in the high seas because, so again, we're only seeing the really large boats in our database. But what fishes in the high seas is mostly really large boats. So we see most of the fishing in the high seas. And so they were able to look at that and conclude that most fishing in the high seas is not profitable without subsidies, which is really, you know, and they could map it and show where it's less profitable. And that just gives you a map of where we're overexploiting the oceans because of subsidies. And that's really interesting and useful. There's another study you can look at that's coming out soon that looks at overlap between sharks and fishing activity and tuna, and so you see what parts of the ocean are sharks at risk to fishing activity. There was another one which looked in Europe, another paper published in Science that showed that a lot of the marine protected areas in Europe are not actually, fishing isn't really restricted there. So actually, if you're a shark, you're more likely to be caught inside the marine protected area than outside the marine protected area. So that was kind of a nice revelation.
So you put that on the shark Instagram pages so they know how to go there.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
So,
but that's good to know if you're thinking about going in the water there. So go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt, but I'm getting a visual for it. They don't know about these restricted areas, but they should.
Yeah.
What about, but you mentioned a government is interested. So to just elaborate on that a little bit. So China wants to know fleet, movement. Are they using it to help enforce their no fishing times? Is it more of like it's kind of Big Brother in a good way?
So you know, we actually have a partnership right now with the U.S. Coast Guard. And a lot of these government agencies have been really good at focusing on kind of what's happening on the water right now, like being able to take a satellite radar image, match it up and track to find a bad vessel that's happening at this moment. But what we focus on is more kind of that big picture, that like long-term analysis of what's like the larger context, like what vessels are operating in this area. And that information is really useful and is something that's not been done as much because it requires a really kind of big data system. And that's good. Another thing is there's a lot of, when I say governments, I'm also including these things called regional fisheries management organizations, which are, they came out of a UN treaty. There are these management organizations which are developed, that are intergovernmental organizations to co-manage the high seas. So in the Pacific, there's, you know, the Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, or the where the Western Pacific, where that's to manage the tuna stocks there, that cross boundaries between some countries' waters and the high seas. And there's a commission there which is, you know, collaborating between them. There's another one in the Northern Pacific Fisheries Commission. And we're working, you know, we talk with them and she can help. They're trying to track vessels and what happens, and they don't always know all the information. Sometimes it's helpful to have our data source.
So it's so exciting. And this is, how long have you been in this field? It's not a trick question. I just want to, how long have you been in the fishing research in that space?
So it's interesting. My background is more in, so I actually studied physics undergrad. And then,
of course, perfect segue.
Yeah. Well, then earth system science for my master's research, because that's kind of interesting. The big thing, more focused on climate change, but I did do oceans track for that, and I've basically worked in global environmental change in kind of both research and communication for the last 15 years, and basically I want to say like six years ago realized that this space of using big data for satellites for environmental monitoring was a big opportunity. It was somewhere where there's going to be a lot of really important work to do. So focused on that. And this is one of the coolest projects that
and exciting partnerships. And the reason I ask you that is because I've been doing this like 12 years, basically 11 for Mrs. Green's World, and really switched from, I came out of the Amazon, which I think is like the land version of the oceans, because they don't even know tribes that are there. They haven't found that, but it's a little bit more complex than the oceans. But I find that recently that the big dogs, as I call them, the really big, big dogs in industries are caring more and more and showing up at the table. I went to the Global Climate Action Summit, lots of focus on water and oceans and the plastic in the oceans, but in general. And then at Green Biz last week and at Bioneers, the big dogs, the head of some of the biggest corporations in the world, are showing up and getting that, paying attention to all of the environmental things going on. There's a big business interest in it, which then, of course, does help benefit the environment. They understand that depletion of all resources will end in a very bad business model. It's like, but you see that? Do you see more interest because you've been involved in it for 15 years?
Yeah, I do, and I don't. I mean, it's hard. You know, some things we're making a lot of progress on, and others it's. There's always this tricky thing between the rate of progress versus the rate of needed progress. And you see that in climate change, especially where you are getting people to care more. You are getting more commitments, but it's about like, you know, order of magnitude slower than it has to be. In oceans, there's definitely been movement behind oceans, and it's exciting to be behind it. And it's also an area, where a lot of the solutions make a lot of sense. It's much easier than climate change because there's ways to conserve the, there's ways to significantly conserve the ocean and make people more money. Like fisheries reform has this dual benefit of both leading to more money for fisheries and having more fish in the ocean.
So interesting. And you're right. So
and it's just
different.
Really hard to do.
Yes.
But there's a clear solution there, and it's much easier. It's much easier than climate change, where the key solution is to basically make, to restrict the use of something people want to sell that they use to sell to make money. Like, right. You can't solve climate change without making people who produce fossil fuels make less money, and that's why it's so hard. But with fisheries, you can actually make more money for the fishermen if you reduce overfishing. It's just the transition, right? They just have to be willing to make a little less money for a little bit of a period of time while the fisheries recover.
Tricky. Right. Not always easy, but you're right. Much more marketable. You can sell that idea. It's really true. But what about like dark fleets? Tell us what dark fleets are. And what about your ability to monitor them and understand the scale and impact of fishing?
I love the phrase dark fleets. They sound very mysterious, but really all they are boats that do not have transponders on them. So we can't, they're not on our.
Got it.
And they're kind of like everything was a dark fleet, basically, until a few years ago when Gold Fishing Watch published everything. And, you know, so that's at least to the public. You know, I think they're so the dark fleet are all the boats that don't have transponders, and that's most of the vessels in the world. And we are starting to, you know, some of these boats will be able to put transponders on, and more boats are getting transponders. And so there are fewer dark vessels each year. But there's a lot that are going to be slow to do so. And what we can do is we can actually use satellite radar and satellite imagery to see them. And so you're not going to get the same kind of nice track of a boat like you do with this, with the transponder data. But you can count vessels. You can see where they are. And that's really cool. And we've started in the last years, there's been, you know, new satellite companies such that you can actually take enough pictures of the ocean to be able to track this stuff. And so we're starting to be able to, using some free satellite radar to identify all of the large metal objects along the world's coastlines. And that includes large fishing vessels. And we're using that
to try to
identify.
You just don't think of them as a large metal object.
Like, yeah, exactly, right? Well, that's what the radar sees.
Yeah.
Radar doesn't know.
They don't know it's a fishing boat from China. Yeah.
Metal reflects really well. So radar is nice because it goes through clouds and you have a hard time with them. And it can also take pictures at night. But the optical imagery is limited by clouds and it's harder. So radar is really exciting. We've been using that to count some of these boats. And it's very nice because you can see in some places what they are. So,
you know, I wonder about, we're going to get into like some really murky waters here. So stay with me. And you always maintain the right to not answer. But I do watch a lot of these specials and I'm always watching, some of the bad ones about the dark side, not the dark fleets, but the dark side of the fishing industry. Can organizations like yours, I realize that you're not a policing organization, but does the data help to put pressure on some of the big offenders that are overfishing and that are, you know, slaughtering dolphins and killing whales when they don't need to? Is there any part of what you're doing? Do you see that as part of your mission? Because I know when I did the research, you know, you have policy and markets and you have advocacy and education as some of your main areas of focus. So are you able to use some of that to, like, I don't know, get the big offenders front and center?
So I think, I think there's like there's kind of this, I think when people first hear Global Fishing Watch, the thing that gets the headlines is catching some of the really bad guys. And that has happened. There was a boat that was fishing in the Phoenix Islands protected area that was caught using Global Fishing Watch technology. And so that's a great story about how we caught illegal fishing. But I think the bigger story is kind of how behavior in general changes once you know you're being watched. And this is like, you know, everyone says they're doing one thing, but if no one's watching, are they actually doing it? And we've seen this in a fish in the fishery in the Southern Ocean where birds get caught in long lines. So long lines, they're these vessels, they set these lines of hooks that can be as much as 100 kilometers, 60 miles long. They're just incredibly long. And it's all day they spend setting them and all day hauling them again. And, you know, they put bait on these hooks. And so you can imagine birds wanting to get that. And so the birds follow the boats and then try to eat the bait and then get caught in the hooks. And albatross are threatened. The southern species of southern albatross are threatened because of this. And so the longline vessels are supposed to do a few things to reduce bycatch. And there's a few things they can do, and they're supposed to do one of the things, the three things they're supposed to do. And one of those things is setting their lines only at night, not during the day. So the idea is that you can if you set them at night, birds are less active and they're less likely to get caught. And so I forget the exact number, but it was like somewhere between 20 and 40% of the boats operating in this area said they set at night. And then we looked in our data, and we were able to train a model to tell, based on how the boat's moving, is it setting during the day or setting during the night, and tell the exact time it's setting. And the reason you can do that is because these long lines have very distinctive patterns. They move at a certain speed in a certain way when putting their lines down, and another way when taking them out of the water. And so we did that, and it turns out almost none of them are setting during the night. I think there was two or three that appeared to be only setting at night, and all the rest of them did some combination or set during the day. And the most common was to start setting right at dawn, which is actually the worst because that's right when birds are most active, right at dawn. So why would anyone follow the regulation if they can't think anyone can watch? But now this data is public. So it's, I think you can no longer be doing one thing and say you're doing another.
So it's so interesting about human behavior, and I think, well, I would never do that. Well, guess what, folks? Yes, I do.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yes, I do. I mean, I was driving the other day, and I couldn't get my Bluetooth to hook up, and it's against the law to talk on your cell phone, and I'm looking around to see if any cops are around to watch me. And I don't think I was putting anybody at risk, but yeah, of course we do that without even knowing. Like, nobody's watching. You can get away with it.
The people working on these longline vessels, it looks like it is hard work.
It is horrible work.
It is, and a lot of the labor violations I was talking about, where people are forced to work at sea, a lot of that's happening on these longline vessels. So, these are people struggling to make a living or being forced to. It's a really, really hard line of work.
And it's hard to change the cultural. I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask about how you can use it, what do you do about cultural beliefs that the use of certain body fish parts have life-changing qualities, whether it's an aphrodisiac or whatever, it makes your life live longer. That's not your job. And I understand that. And I just wonder how much of an impact it does have. Like, it's kind of like a byproduct of knowing you're being watched. And as you were talking, what I wonder is, TV sensationalizes things or dramatizes things sometimes. Sometimes the stories just tell themselves. Like, I just heard saw a presentation by Paul Nicklin, the wildlife, national wildlife photographer. And his pictures don't lie. I mean, it just, you can't even get your head around some of the things he said, but it doesn't necessarily follow through where it impacts a cultural belief. People believe that, so they cut off shark fins. And you know what I mean? It's like, probably big data won't help solve that problem.
Cultural change can, though. I mean, cultures change. People change.
I believe
start
I have
realizing
to believe that.
That conservation is important.
And there's other things that we can do. Like in the case of Sado, we're really talking about ecotourism and it's working. And we have some projects where you just have to give fishermen other things to do and another way to put food on the table. Literally, it's all they know for generations. It's not like they're going in this nesting area and trying to deplete it. They need to bring stuff home. So I really understand that. I've grown a lot from being on that board and understanding how it really works. What about some of your research partners. I love that. To me, partnerships are the way of the future, locally, regionally, nationally, internationally. Partners matter. What are some of the partners you have, and what are they doing that either impacts or is important to the work you're doing at Global Fishing Watch?
So there's research partners, and then there's impact partners. You know, I think that the study, there's kind of the study I told you about with the long lines.
Right. That's one. Yes.
That was done and the through sharks. BirdLife International, that was done through an NGO that wanted to do this research, and they had information. They knew what the question was. They knew about the long. That wasn't us. Said like, you know, that was them who said like, here are the questions and the information, and they came to us and we did the data science to figure out what the answer was, and so it was a very nice collaboration. And then there was the. And then there's things like the researchers at Stanford that are doing that comparison between fishing effort and sharks and tuna, and they're looking at, and that was kind of a research-driven question, which will then go to inform policy, policy. I think there is there's kind of the importance. You know, I think one thing in general I've learned on this big data stuff is that the people that know the right questions to ask and are the world experts in things don't have the in-house capability to do the kind of big data engineering and analyses. And so a lot of my work is basically connecting those two things.
That's
so
that amazing. But that's amazing. There used to be like intellectual property and, you know, we're not sharing our research with this, but you, one of the things I love and it just jumped out at me is that the information and the data you're collecting is free and transparent. And that's huge in this day and age.
Yep.
It's like, especially
yep.
I think about smaller countries that don't have a lot of money, and it makes it accessible and available from the smallest to the biggest fish, no pun intended.
Yep.
What about climate change? Needless to say, I was going to bring that up, but you're the director of research. Can you talk about what you're seeing in terms of the impact of climate change, not just on, you know, like the numbers of fish out there, but what are you seeing as the temperatures continue to rise and as, you know, sea levels continue to rise? I'm one of those people that happens to believe all those facts, and I want to know are you seeing?
The first thing to do is to be thankful for the ocean, because it is absorbing most of the heat that we're generating.
Right.
And so it is making the Earth warm much more slowly than it would be otherwise. So that is the first step. The second is, the ocean's changing. And, you know, there's been a lot of research out there. You know, there was just a paper came out the other week that basically looked at how fisheries have changed the last 100 years because of climate change. So we can already measure these things. So overall, there's been a slight decline. Some fisheries have done better, but more have done worse, which is kind of, you know, the general story of
right.
climate change. It's kind of, you know, almost boring the way that turns out everywhere. Like, some things do better, most do worse. And then looking forward, you're going to see more of that. There's some really, so that's obviously, you know, that's kind of the high level challenge. There's the problem with coral reefs of, bleaching, and there's real uncertainty over what their future is in a warmer climate. From a management standpoint, there's these kind of interesting challenges of fish moving across different boundaries, because you imagine that there's lots of these boundaries in the ocean. You become aware of them. If you look at the Global Fishing Watch map at globalfishingwatch.org, you see all these fishing clumps around all. It's really crazy if you look at it. Fishing like clumps around all of these boundaries that you didn't realize were there in the ocean, but they're there. They're like the the economic zones of each country. And excuse me, you'll see all this fishing that's on the high seas that comes right along the edge of those, because they're not allowed to fish inside, but the good fish kind of are near the edge. So you see all these lines where people are fishing. Now imagine you move all the fish by 100 miles because the climate's changed. You know, they all move north or south, or they all move away from the equator. Suddenly now fish are in different places, and you have all these different. The question is, how do you manage? You have to manage that fish stock. We've already seen some issues with this in Iceland, where some fish are moving north, and then Icelandic fishers it changed which country was phishing it, and then it was no longer managed well. So there's this extra challenge of management as fish stocks move across borders.
That was one of the things I watched. I watched a special on the changing fishing industry on Iceland. I mean, there's lots of specials. And it was like, well, guess what? They're going out there and there aren't any fish in some of the areas that they typically fish. So there's like that whole ripple effect and hoping for another, you know, different kinds of solutions. This is like maybe the most impossible question to ask.
Yeah.
What? Like, we have great shows, great guests, and you're one of them. You know a lot. I get it. Fishing matters. People live by it. They die by it. It's a huge industry for millions, billions of people, so it really matters. But for our listeners who care deeply about the environment and sustainability and social justice, that's who is part of the Mrs. Green's World Tribe. They're involved. What can we do? Like, one thing I think about is I got invited to the Seafood Watch Sustainable Fishing Conference they had. I went 3 years in a row and educated myself about telling people to use the Seafood Watch app, and what you order in your restaurant really matters. I was just a sustainability judge up in Phoenix for 50 restaurants, asking the chefs about their sustainability practices.
What did you learn?
I learned that it blew me away. Like, it really did. Every chef I talked to, first of all, wanted to talk to me. It's the first time they added criteria as a judge. This organization is called Devour, and there are thousands of people that go. They fly in food critics from all over the country to judge the food. And this year, they added the sustainability judge. So I'm like, how's this going to go over? But I approached people, and I said, this is not to judge or whatever. I had a very nice, sincere way of putting it. I said, it's really to up-level the conversation around sustainability. Every chef stopped what they were doing and wanted to talk to me, except for two of all the ones I interviewed, and they wanted to talk to me, and some of them were frustrated about the lack of fresh seafood in Arizona, of course. If the high-end restaurants, you know, they're flying it in, and that's important, they said, and I asked them, are your consumers asking more questions? 2-1, they said yes. That they're asking, where is your pork raised? How does your cow get killed? But consumers, they definitely see an increase just in the past 2 years. So I wonder, what would you say to our listeners? I mean, we have thousands of listeners. What can we do to help impact the fishing in the oceans? Because it's all connected. It has an impact on us. Believe it or not, there is an impact on us.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think you said that, I think each of us needs to what we do does matter. You know, I think it's easy to think what we do doesn't matter, because you have to think about yourself as a single human, and that, you know, I'm not going to stop climate change, but I can make a difference at the scale of me. If I can make a scale bigger, you know, if I can impact more than just one person's worth of effort through doing things, then that's a difference, and that's important. You know, I would say if you want to protect the oceans, one thing to do is to fight climate change, is to figure out how to reduce your emissions, because that's something that will be extremely helpful. So that's always my sense of thing, one of the first things to do. The other, I think, is, as you said, downloading that app and checking, asking restaurants. When they get asked, as you said, they start doing things. So I think asking at seafood restaurants is a very good step to take. Just where does your fish come from? Even if they don't tell you an answer that makes any sense, if you don't know what to do with that answer, the fact that they got asked means that they will, you know, have to start thinking asked on it.
And I'm gonna do more research for my next year, because some of these chefs were talking about, you know, getting sea bass from Chile, and I'm like, dude, that is not very sustainable. When you're measuring the whole imprint, like, that is not, you're not getting a plus for that on my sheet. So, there are things like that. But to your point, it's so important that the last thing in the world you want to say is there's nothing I can do. Consumers rule. And Americans eat fish in restaurants like crazy. They're a significant part of the consumption of fish globally. High end, right? So yeah, mm-hmm. consumers can be conscious and make sure that you're watching things that are on the green list. I think there's green, blue, and red. I'm not sure, but green is good, blue is eh, and red is don't eat it, and you shouldn't eat it. It's, you know, and I had, do you know who Sylvia Earle is, the blue heart of the ocean?
Yes.
Oh my God, of course you do. And I had her on my show, and I didn't have to talk at all. My husband said, you should just put the phone down and just let her rip, because yeah. she talked, and she said, nobody should ever eat fish ever again. It's disgusting. I mean, she doesn't hold back. And she said, shrimp? Nobody should ever put a piece of shrimp in their mouth again, because you know it's poisoning you. I mean, she was a riot, but yeah. I've said to people, when they ask me about shrimp, I say, you know, the answer, I'm allergic to fish, so I'm pretty lucky in terms of having to not make a moral decision. But I'm like, you probably shouldn't eat shrimp. I mean, that's the truth. It's like, either for your health or for how it's sourced, it's getting to be a big deal. But I just say to people now, I sound like I'm just a politician. I say, you know what? It's complicated. But the truth is, it is complicated. And if people want to know more, I can tell them. But
there's trade-offs too. Like, you can't, if you want to not eat fish, you know, if you don't eat fish, but instead you eat beef, that's really bad.
That's really bad.
really, really bad. Right. But and there are some forms of seafood, especially like some mussels that you can eat, that are better than vegan diets in terms of environmental impact. There's a good paper that came on that recently. So I think it's not clear cut, but we need to get our food from somewhere.
We need to get our food from somewhere. It's so true.
And I have found this to be actually an interesting philosophical question that I have not personally resolved, which is, how do I feel about if you're going to eat meat, how should you feel about eating meat from wild caught ecosystems? We're radically changing the ecosystem, but you know, it's still there, still intact, you know, versus from a farm which has totally overrun the local ecosystem, has destroyed it, but it's on a much smaller area. You know, I think there's lots of hard questions like that. And it's worth noting that through fishing we have really changed the world's oceans. It's, you know, there's been a huge to sustainably harvest a fishery, what is considered sustainable, you actually cut the biomass, the number of fish in that fishery is half of what it would be in a natural unfished environment. So you've cut the number of fish in half. That's the state of the ocean when sustainably harvested. Is that what we want? Is that better than where we get food from otherwise? I think these are some hard questions.
They are. You're just validating my point. It's complicated. It's really complicated, and a lot of people don't want to think about it. So basically, your advice or your feedback is just really decide what your position is on consuming fish. It's not a big deal. It's not a heavy lift, especially with something like Seafood Watch. You can put that app on your phone and go to a restaurant.
Yeah,
it takes two seconds.
And that's the thing. I say these hard questions. There's the easy ones, which are like, look, we're not managing fisheries well. We should be doing a much better job of it. And yes, figuring out which of those fish you should not eat is incredibly useful.
So the other hard question is, this is terrible. I mean, I kind of eat, sleep, and drink the IPCC report on mm-hmm. climate change. So ours is a disruptor for good path. You know, let's raise the consciousness about it. How are you feeling? You're dedicated, you're passionate, you're informed, you're learning. How do you feel about our 12 years to change? Are people, do you have hope? That's basically my question. Do you have hope? Do you see a lot of hope? Or do you think we really need to pump up the volume?
I think for climate change, we need to keep up pumping up the volume. You know, I spent a lot of time, actually, this is spent a lot of time in another, before I worked on this, looking into kind of how to, I think that it's still not as big of an issue in the, you know, I think a lot of us who spend our time thinking about environmental issues and talk about climate change think that it's this thing that everyone thinks about, but it's not yet, even though it's And so I really think it's, you know, I think there's been a lot of research into how to communicate climate change and what makes difference. And I think it's just, you know, I don't think you can, I still don't think people are hearing enough about it.
And I totally agree with you. Like, even something as simple as going to a store and seeing someone take 20 plastic bags out with their 20 items and me and me trying to be quiet. It's like plastic bags and straws can be a gateway to consciousness. And it's there are just thousands and thousands of people to me walking around in the climate change coma. And it's, you know, if a wildfire destroys your entire community, like in Paradise, you're starting to pay a lot more attention. But even that, it seems like it's forgotten rather quickly. And our show is our whole purpose, our mission for being is to raise the consciousness and have people engage in conversations around climate change.
And I think one of the most important things is just to talk to people about it. A lot of things about what can you do and how can you influence people. And it's actually really hard to influence people you don't know. So you should focus on the people you know.
Right. And I do. And all of them are paranoid, especially when they have parties. They're like, oh God, Gina's coming. We can't use paper plates or plastic forks. And I'm like, yeah, good. I hope you're paranoid. okay. So the call to action I would add is to check out the website because it's one that you want to look around and click on. Globalfishingwatch.org is a great website. And it's easy to navigate and there's information, especially if you are a fish eater. You are what you eat, so be careful and make sure it's sustainably sourced. And David, thank you. I know you're busy. I know you had a bunch of calls today, but I had fun and I learned things and I hope it was the same for you. At least the fun part. It was great hearing what you had to share.
Yeah, it was great to chat with you.
My last word before I'm going to promote the upcoming shows and Down to Earth, our local show is with Christina Palsgrobe. She's going to be talking about the first R, people. This is to David's point. The first R is reduce. It's not recycle. And what's happening on the local scene in terms of the impact of China's decision and how that relates to Earth Day. So she's back as a return guest, good friend. And then on April 23rd, I literally cannot wait for this national show. It's Monica Gagliano, who's a research associate professor and adjunct senior research fellow at the University of Western Australia. We're going to be talking about imagination, science, and the mind of plants. This is a woman that has done a lot in research of microdosing of LSD and the use of ayahuasca, so I can't wait. So here's my last word. Our team lives in the reality and with the consciousness that as a planet and in the face of climate change, we have 12 years to make dramatic changes when it comes to our behaviors as citizens or face catastrophic results. I think it's safe to say that the average American is not totally aware of the billions of people who do, in fact, rely on fish as their primary source of protein. Overfishing, plastic pollution, and warming temperatures are all real-world problems and challenges that need to be addressed, overcome, and call for massive changes. Global Fishing Watch is not only aware of the myriad of complex and complicated challenges we face, they are about finding solutions by promoting ocean sustainability through greater transparency. Their cutting-edge technology is used to visualize, track, and share data about global fishing activity in nearly real time and for free, and we applaud them for that. Please remember that the 12 years to change clock is ticking, and our actions now are already impacting our present and our future. I invite you to think about how your actions can impact fishing on a global scale. Thank you for being a part of Mrs. Green's World, and David, once again, thanks for saying yes to the interview.
Thank you much. It was great to be on your show.